Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's really great to be back. I spent a full year here 20 years ago, so KITP has changed a lot, but this hall is still around. I have an ambitious title, Disordered Systems in Physics, Information Theory, and Computer Science. Of course, I will not survey all that. That's totally impossible. I will try to point some directions, and there are in the audience experts on each of these topics, and they will probably find that it is too elementary, but my aim is to make connection between the different experts, let's say. So I have six chapters that I want to address. I will insist a lot on ensembles, and I would like to start with that. I will go back briefly to spin glasses, because of the spin glass cornucopia, as it was once described. In spin glasses, you have a bunch of spins, which in simple case you can describe as just Ising variable, take binary variable plus or minus one. You have an energy function, which is a coupling by pairs, and the Boltzmann distribution, equilibrium Boltzmann distribution, is e to the minus beta, the energy, is a probability distribution of a configuration. A spin glass sample, well, maybe it's okay, maybe I will not use this one. Better. A spin glass sample is thus described by the whole set of the couplings. And the couplings in a spin glass, for instance, in copper manganese, you have manganese impurities. Depending on their distance, the coupling can be either ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. The sign of GIJ depends on the distance. And so in principle, if you have a spin glass with 10 to the 23 spins in it, describing the sample in itself is totally impossible. And so immediately, soon enough, it was understood that one had to use an ensemble. An ensemble was to say how you generate the spin glass. So ideally, if you want to be close to the experiment, for instance, you will say, look, I have 1% of manganese impurities. I assume that the experimentalist has done a good job. They are at random positions. They don't diffuse, they are at fixed distances. And then the JIJ is a deterministic function oscillating with distance, RKKY function. So you could do this ensemble. A simpler ensemble is just to say the JIJ are normal. They are Gaussian distribution of mean zero and with 1 over n. Or if you have a ferromagnetic bias, they have a mean J0 over N and JIJ squared average is 1 over N. So this is the ensemble that has been most studied. There is also the possibility of studying the other ensembles in which you have finite connectivity, in which each spin interacts with a finite number of other spins. So for instance, generated from an Erdős-Reni random graph. So this was from the very beginning, one wants to study a typical typical sample generated from an ensemble. And it is behind that idea is the fact that there is a notion of self-averaging. That is, if you look at, everything has been scaled in such a way that the energy scales extensively with the number of spin, it is of order n. And so the partition function is exponentially large or small. It behaves exponentially in n, e to the minus beta n, times the free energy density of the sample characterized by the set of j's. Now, the probability of finding a sample with a given value of the free energy density, it satisfies a large deviation principle. This is not totally obvious. It has to be proven, but it was the basic hypothesis with which physicists had been working for many years and which was proven in some cases later on. So if you have such a large deviation principle, then it means that if the probability of finding a sample with fj equal f is e to the n phi of f, and phi has this kind of shape, then it means that almost all samples have the same free energy density f star. This is very important because it tells you that almost all the samples have the same thermodynamics, same phase diagram, and there are a lot of other properties which you can deduce, which are true for the typical sample in the ensemble. Then, of course, you can, on top of that, you could look at properties of rare samples, rare instances. But that's something that I will not address. So just to be complete, to recall what has been shown long ago for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, in which the ensemble is Gaussian couplings. You have a phase diagram, which is this one. J0 is a ferromagnetic bias, the mean of the couplings. T is the temperature, 1 over beta. And you have a paramagnetic phase, a spin glass phase, a ferromagnetic phase, and a mixed phase. So paramagnetic versus ferromagnetic, it's easy. The order parameter is just the total magnetization. You compute the expectation value of the spin, average over all the spins. It turns out that this global magnetization, it is, again, a self-averaging property, and you can compute it. If it is positive, you have a ferromagnet. If it is zero, you have a paramagnet. That's easy. The one which is more complicated is to compute with the order, to know the order parameter for the spin glass. The spin glass, actually, what you have to do is to take two copies. You generate two spin configurations. Generate one spin configuration S, another S prime, and you look at the overlap between them. The overlap is just the scalar product, so sum of SI, SI prime. And this overlap is called Q, and you look at the probability of the overlap. And what you find if you decrease temperature, for instance, at high temperature you have one delta function. It means that any two spin configuration generically with probability 1, they are the same distance, they have the same angle, characterized by Q. But then if you go beyond a certain temperature, this function P of Q, it has two delta peaks and a continuous part. And this transition is continuous in the sense that if you look close to TC, you have the initial delta peak, which starts to broaden, and it broadens continuously. So this is just an example of how you can, in one case, how you can compute a phase diagram which will apply to almost all samples in an ensemble. Now, this situation is very common if you have problems of large dimensions. You have the same thing in information theory. If you want to use error correcting codes for transmitting any kind of information, whether it is machines that we have built or whether it is in biology, you have the basic principle of error correction. It is just that you have an initial message, you encode it by adding redundancy, transmit it through the channel, and then you will receive the message, and using the redundancy, you will decode and try to recover the initial message. So just to give one example, if you use the most naive one is to use a repetition code in which you have the initial message. If it is a 0, you send 3 times 0. If it is a 1, you send 3 times 1. That's called rate 1/3. It means you have sent 3 times as much bits as the original message. And then you will decode. So if you want to send 1011, you send this thing. Imagine it goes through a channel which is just called binary symmetric channel. It flips a bit with a certain probability P. Then maybe you will receive this message here, and you will decode by triplets using a majority rule. So 111 will be decoded as 1, 000 is decoded as 0, 110 is decoded as 1, etc. So you see that you have made, here it had made one mistake, and it has been corrected. So that's very easy. And you can immediately see that if the probability of flipping a bit is P, in the small p limit, you have the error probability is like p squared, 3p squared. So Shannon came up with this scheme and with a very nice theorem, which was to say that for a given noise level, one can build a couple of encoder decoder which transmits with zero error if the rate is less than a certain amount. There are two ingredients in that. There is the use of a thermodynamic limit, exactly as we were doing in spin glasses. In this case, it means that both the size of the original message and the size of the encoded message, they go to infinity at a fixed ratio, giving the rate. And there is an ensemble. That is, in Shannon, again, it is not that he has described one code and studies one code. He describes an ensemble of code. He describes a probability distribution on codes, and he will analyze the typical behavior of a code picked up from this probabilistic ensemble. And the code is very simple. You have to define a code. You have to say what are the words that you are able to send. For instance, if you had repetition codes, you could send only words which have three times the same letter, then three times the same letter, then three times the same letter. Here, you take just the unit hypercube in large dimension, in n dimension. You take random points, and these are the code words. So you take 2 to the r n iid random points with uniform distribution. And this is your code book. And that's what you will send. So you see that for each realization of this thing here, you have a code book, you have a code. The sender and the receiver, they know the code book. Now what will happen? Imagine that you have sent this code word here. Imagine that you send it through a binary symmetric channel with flip probability P. Well, then with high probability, after the channel, you will have flipped P times N bits. And so you will receive something which is on a sphere of radius P times N starting from the initial code word. And so what the receiver will do is to look at this sphere. He receives this point. He computes the sphere centered on this point, and he's trying to see if there is a code word on this sphere. And so there are two regimes. There is a regime in which there is a single code word on the sphere, and that's a code word that was sent. And there is another regime in which there are actually many code words on the sphere, and then he cannot decide, and the code does not work. Now, the thing which is quite nice is the fact that with this ensemble, there is a sharp phase transition. That is, you go from a situation in which with probability 1 at distance p times n from the received message, there is a single code word, which is the one that had been sent, and then the code works perfectly. And then if you go beyond a certain threshold, you have with probability 1 that on the sphere, and actually even inside the sphere, there are many other code words, exponentially large number. And so there is no way to decide. So this means that you have a sharp phase transition. The probability of perfect decoding, it goes from 1 to 0 at a critical value of the noise. And it's a geometric phase transition. You see, it's just described, these small drawings give you an idea that it's a purely geometric phase transition. It's a geometry of random points under a large dimensional unit hypercube.
So the noise is the radius of the sphere?
The noise is the radius of the sphere. Yes. You have sent this word here, you flip p times n bits, you go here, you know the properties of the channel, you assume that the level of noise of the channel is known. So the receiver constructs the sphere of radius p times n and looks for a code word on this sphere. Put some resolution p times n plus something and all the thing. Okay? So last example of a phase. So this is a behavior for a typical code generated from the ensemble. Now I want to insist a third time in the ensemble with the last example, which is in computer science, which is random satisfiability, in which you take n binary variables, you take m constraints, which take the form of clause. So 0 is for false, 1 is for true, and you take the or of the variables or their negation. So the clause x1 or not x2 or x3, it will be correct, except if the clause is true, except if x1 is false, x2 is true, x3 is false. In all the other cases, it's true. Okay. So each clause puts a constraint. Each clause of three variables, it says that among the 8 configurations of the three variable, one of them is forbidden. Okay. Now you ask for whether there is a configuration of the Xi which satisfies all the constraints. I will not, I'm going, sorry, a bit fast, but it's an important problem in computer science. It's a kind of grandfather of all the NP-complete problems, the first one that was proven to be NP-complete. And using this one, then you can prove that a lot of other systems are NP-complete. And it is also known that KSAT, that is when you look at clauses of a fixed length, for instance, k equal 3 or k equal 4, a given value of k is also NP-complete. Now, again, I would like to go to an ensemble. It turned out that for quite a few years, the colleagues in computer science realized that if you generate a satisfiability formula more or less randomly, often they are very easy. But then, when are they hard? Well, there is one factory of hard instances, which is random KSAT. That is, you generate each clause of length k by randomly chosen variables among all the set of n variables or their negation. Okay, you take n variables, x1 up to xn, and you take k of them, and you negate them with probability 1/2. That's one clause. Take another clause. And then you have an ensemble. Now, again, this ensemble, it has a thermodynamic and it has a phase diagram, which is self-averaging, and so you can prove that there is a sharp phase transition, in the sense that the system below a certain threshold. So this is the case for k equal 3, for instance. There is a threshold around 4.26 something. This is alpha is the ratio of clause two variables. And I take a thermodynamic limit in which the number of variables goes to infinity, the number of clauses go to infinity, but the size of the clause k is fixed, and the ratio clauses to variable is fixed. And what happens if you look, you generate a random KSAT instance like that, then you can show that below a certain critical point with probability 1, the formula is satisfiable, and beyond it with probability 1, the formula is not satisfiable. And that would be what you see with simulations with n equal 50, 100, or 200. So this had been conjectured using statistical physics method and has been recently proven for k large enough. So these were three examples of the use of ensembles. And now I would like to take to go to chapter 2. And mention a little bit some stories of landscapes. And I want to get a little bit deeper into satisfiability. So you take the random satisfiability that I was describing before, you can define a cost function, which is the number of violated clause. Okay, and if you have k equal 3, for instance, these are three body interactions. And then you can find the configuration of lowest cost. If it has zero cost, it means that every clause is satisfied. So then you can look at the measure, which is a uniform measure over all SAT assignments. If you take the clauses, given instance of clauses, and you look at the uniform measure on SAT assignment, if there are SAT assignments, of course, otherwise you don't look at the problem. And many works on that have come up with the idea that there is a SAT on SAT transition. So depending on the ratio number of clauses per variable, this is a big transition, SAT on SAT, that the one that everybody was seeking and that has been proven and nicely. But in some sense, in order to prove to understand its location, its value, and prove it, it was very important to realize that there was a series of geometrical transitions, and these are the main ones. These are the most important transitions. So here in green, I am trying to give a pictorial idea of the landscape. The landscape, the green points, imagine that the green points, they are configuration of the variables. So it's a unit hypercube in large dimension, notoriously hard to draw on a blackboard. But here, basically, if the number of clauses is small enough, then you have a big connected cluster of solution. So basically, it means that if you have found a solution, you will find another solution nearby, and so on. You can have a random walk around the solution. And the phase. That's a phase in which actually finding a solution is quite easy. I will show some examples of algorithm later. Then there is a dynamical phase transition in which the big cluster of solution separates into a large number of separated clusters with a minimal distance. So you find a solution here, but then all this is about the n, so it's not trivial. I mean, if you have to jump from a solution in this cluster to the solution of this other cluster, you will have to flip over the n variables. And so it's not easy to guess. Then there is what is called a one RSB glass transition, which means that it gives an idea of the measure. The measure which was on a full cluster. The measure is now on discontinuous, disconnected clusters. And now at some point the measure concentrates on a finite number of clusters. So what we call a static phase transition. It will mean that there will be these are called also pure states. And then beyond that and that transition, there is no solution at all. So all this geometric organization is an example of phase transition that happens in the KSAT problem for k larger or equal to 4, and that is correct for any sample generated randomly with probability 1. So it will be the typical behavior of any sample.
If you are in the MSAT case,
yes,
you look at you no longer have solution, but you look at the minima or
quasi-minima. Yes.
Is it also
better
like that?
Yes.
Also on a finite?
On a finite
number of components?
Oh, there will be condensation, yes. Yes. Yes, it's a RSB phase. It's not been studied in all that so many details, but so this idea of a geometric transition is interesting, and it tells you immediately one thing which is very special is that when you are in the clustered phase, typically when you are here, this I call the clustered phase, because there are discontinuous, disconnected clusters of solution, you have an exponentially large number of clusters. So you can rank the clusters by their size. How many solutions do they contain? So each cluster, a given cluster, call it mu, has an exponentially large number of solutions. That's an entropy. Okay, it has an entropy, and it's the entropy of the cluster is S mu, entropy density of the cluster. And so basically you can construct a function which is a complexity, which will tell you how many clusters there are of a given size. So typically I will ask, how many clusters are there with an entropy density equal to S? And these clusters, they are e to the n sigma of S. And that's the complication, the fact that there are two sources of entropy in some sense. I mean, the number of solutions inside a cluster is exponentially large in n, and the number of clusters, even of a given size, is also exponentially large in n. So now, if you are in this situation, which is a situation for KSAT, well, you will want to find what is the total number of solution, and the total number of solution, you have to sum over all the clusters e to the n s mu, and you will find that this is given by the maximum of the function sigma of s plus s. That is, you have, again, you have like a kind of large deviation principle. So now, how does it look like? So for instance, if you look at 4SAT, you will find that sigma of S, the complexity function, it looks like this. So this is alpha, this is the number of constraint. In 4SAT, you have the three important transition. They are at 9.38 is where the clusters appear, and 9.93 is the SAT and SAT. And the condensation, which I was talking about, is at 9.55. So here are three curves. This is at 9.45. So you have, this is the complexity, the log of the number of clusters of a given entropy, of a given size. And here, if you want to find the maximum of sigma of S plus S, you find that the dominant clusters, they are here. So there are exponentially many of them. If you increase a bit the number of constraints, you go to 9.70, you cross the condensation, and you find that the maximum of sigma of S plus S, the point where this curve here has a slope equal to minus 1, is at sigma equals zero. So it means that you have condensed. You no longer have an exponentially large number. The most important clusters, the one that will contain the solutions, generically, they have a zero complexity. And it's the same at 9.90. And this curve disappears at 9.93. There is nothing left. So it is really realizing this geometry that was crucial in order to get the in order to understand even the Saturn-Sat transition. So what I have shown you is actually two families of glasses. One was the SK model, in which we have this transition which takes the other parameter is the probability of that two random configurations have overlap Q, and it starts to broaden below a certain temperature. And the other one is a discontinuous transition, sometimes called one-step replica symmetry breaking, which is like that. You start at high temperature or low number of constraints. It's the same thing. It plays the same role. You start with a P of Q, which is trivial. And then below a certain TC, you have the clusters that appear and that condense. But it happens that between TC and TD, you have nothing on the thermodynamics. There is no condensation, but the clusters already exist. So you have actually two transitions, one at a certain TD where the clusters start to exist, and one at TC in which they condense. And when they condense, you will see it on the thermodynamic object, which is a probability that two random configurations have a certain overlap Q.
Can you go back a slide?
Yes, sure.
So in the middle case,
yes.
So here there are still exponentially many clusters, it's just that
the uniform
dominated by this very small number of clusters.
Yes.
By a finite number.
Exactly, because they are larger. Here, in this situation or in that one, you have exponentially large number of clusters, but if you pick up a configuration randomly, it will fall here in the large ones. They dominate the measure. And so in order to see the others, you can see the others, but you have to do something. If you just stay on the Boltzmann measure, you don't see them because they are exponentially subdominant.
And yes. You have temperature scales here? That is, if you change your alpha, can you follow the clusters, or do they change with alpha?
They will. Well, the problem is that they disappear.
Yes.
If you increase alpha, you have some that disappear, and you don't know which one are disappearing.
Yeah,
if the question is whether you can follow easily.
You know, like if you take a spherical piece being pure,
yes.
You can, and if you mix it, you can't.
Yes. So but that's a one-step, that's a complicated case.
So this one is like the mixed piece.
It's the one that has a discontinuous transition in which you cannot follow. Okay, so one way of seeing this transition is taking two copies of two spin configurations at random from the Boltzmann measure. So I have a spin configuration S taken from the Boltzmann measure, another one S prime taken from the Boltzmann measure. That's how I compute P of Q. But it's also interesting to couple them, that is to add a small coupling epsilon sum over I S I S I prime. So if epsilon is positive, I like to align them. If epsilon is negative, I like to push them far apart. So if I do that, for instance, in the first case, in a problem like with full RSB, like the SK model, what I will find at low temperature is that if there is a small attraction with the replicas, in the limit epsilon going to zero, the overlap between these two replicas, it will go to the largest value. So at high temperature, I have a single overlap. And then at low temperature, when epsilon goes to zero plus, I have this curve. And when epsilon goes to zero minus, it will go to this curve. So that's one way of seeing the transition. Now, associated with that, there is an energy landscape, which I tried to draw. It's completely messy, but anyhow, in any case, it's impossible to draw. So, but what we know is that there is an ultrametric structure with many pure states, with the states can be organized on an ultrametric tree. One thing that I wanted to mention, because I think there are quite a lot of works going on in the last few months or weeks or days actually on this, is the use, how to exploit the hierarchical structure for an algorithm. And Andrea has come up 3 days ago, or was it 4 days ago, or 2 days ago? I came up with a paper explaining basically how you can anneal in Q. Q is will be the overlap. So if you have Q equals zero, in some sense, it means that you anneal over all the landscape. And then if you go to larger Q, you will have a smaller and smaller radius. And so in some sense, what he is doing is looking at the properties of this, what we called years ago, 30 years ago probably, the ancestor states. That is, if you have several states, you can build the ancestor, which is the one which along the ultrametric tree, and the ancestor state has a smaller overlap. So in some sense, if you can anneal with the overlap, you could probably find a solution, and that's what is being done now. And there are many other, several other papers, I did not mention all of them, but I think this is something which is quite quite interesting, in the sense that it seems that when you have this full RSB, at least in the case of SK model, but one can conjecture that it will be more general than that, you can exploit the structure. In the end, it gives you some type of correlation in the landscape, even if it is very shaky. And you can exploit these correlations in order to build an algorithm that will find not, maybe not the exact ground state. The exact ground state is extremely sensitive to any small perturbation. But if you fix your objective to be to find a configuration which is within epsilon of the true ground state, then the algorithm of Andrea does it in what, n square time or n square steps, yes. So it means that you can really exploit the structure of this landscape, which is quite remarkable. And one can ask a few questions around that, but maybe it's not, well, we can discuss that later in the week.
You can represent the landscape perfectly with all the barriers, using this connectivity graphs. So it's been done for spin glasses and paramagnetic glasses by Chiplock nearly 20 years ago. It's been changed again in the landscape.
You mean what, in small systems or?
Quite reasonable ones.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he compared ferromagnetic with around these spin lines,
mm-hmm.
continuous degrees of free light exchange.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, this idea of annealing in overlap and the fact that the landscape has this kind of structure, it can be used. I wanted to put this slide because I think it was also a case in which you can use that in order to try to get some intuitive understanding on some experiments on spin glasses. And in this case, these are experiments on the linear response to a small magnetic field. So you put a magnetic field and you look at this magnetic susceptibility, how it responds, how the system develops a magnetization. Here it's out of phase magnetization and doesn't matter. Take the response of the linear response of the system to a magnetic field. It's this response, it turns out that it decreases with time. For instance, this is after time 400 minutes at a system which is in its spin glass phase. You put a small magnetic field and the susceptibility decreases this way. So it means that the system is aging slowly on a very long time scale. Now, the experiment that had been done by the group around Eric Vincent, etc. at SPEC was the following. You take a system at 12K, then you decrease the temperature to 10K, and then what happens is that when you decrease the temperature, you find that the susceptibility changes. So the system realizes that the dynamics, it is seeing a new dynamic, seeing a new landscape, basically. This susceptibility as a way of testing the landscape. I mean, why the susceptibility is evolving on this very long, long time scale, is because the system is evolving in his energy landscape. And so here it finds a new landscape. And then you take it back to 12K, and you find this curve here. Again, there is a new dynamics. And the thing which was remarkable that, okay, you have to do it carefully with the value of T1, T2, T3 and the jump in temperature, but there are regimes in which you have this curve here, in which you can say now if I cut the new dynamics that happen at temperature 10K and I glue the two pieces, I find the I find the relaxation that I would have found if I had stayed only at 12K. So this is one example of a phenomenon that has been seen on spin glasses that is amusing, and you can try to build an intuition of how it goes. I mean, it's not trivial. It's not trivial in the sense that the system is aging. System is trying, it's not at equilibrium, it's exploring its landscape. It's exploring, and the more it explores the landscape, the less it is, the smaller the susceptibility, basically. Then you lower the temperature and you restart the dynamics. It has a larger susceptibility. And then it has its own dynamics at 10K. And then you go back to 12K and you can forget about what had happened at 10K. So one way of understanding that was a kind of annealing, and I mentioned it with respect to this idea of annealing in Q in some sense, is the following, that basically we have this landscape, and the landscape, if you think of it as a hierarchical landscape, what will happen is that when you go, you have the system is exploring its valley, which has all its rough landscape within one valley in which it is confined. But then when you go to 10K, you will lower the energy, and it will have a sub-valley which is accessible. And it will start to explore all the detours of the sub-valley with all the sub-sub-valleys and so on. It will have this small dynamics. You go back to 12K and it goes back to the previous level. That's one intuitive way. And okay, I'm not sure it is related at all with the algorithm to find the ground state of the SK model, but at least I thought interesting to mention it. I know. I know.
And then the intuition is wrong because you can go up in temperature to 14 degrees.
Yes.
And if you wait to the right scale of the time, you get the same phenomenon.
It's not exactly true. I mean, if you go up in temperature, you don't keep the memory of what had happened.
No, you do. Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think so. No.
But this is really dependent on the states, primarily on the states changing the temperature.
Yes, but as you know, there are two ways of understanding that. I mean, either you can say that it's because of state change in temperature, but what I claim is that you can get a very good intuition. And again, I claim that there is an asymmetry between going up in temperature. If you go from 12 to 14 and then to 12, it's not the same thing as going from 12 to 10 and then to 12 again. Okay, well, we can discuss it, but what I claim is that there is this intuition here which goes the same way as the one that I see with the annealing in Q.
Could this be proved in a generalized random energy model type thing?
This thing here?
Yeah. Okay, every complexity, you
just well,
have
you tell
purely,
me.
Purely tree-like
you tell me. I don't know what can be proved. That maybe yes. In the Gram probably yes. Yes. In the discontinuous transition, let me just mention what happens if you do the two coupled replicas as before. Well, you will find a discontinuous transition. That is, if you start with two replicas below TC, you will find two branches. That is, you have a discontinuous value. If you have a small attraction, you will find that the two replicas, they take the largest overlap, and otherwise they find the smallest overlap. And it means that you had a big cluster in the KSAT case, you had a big cluster, and it decomposes suddenly in disconnected clusters. So here the landscape is much more golf course, much harder to exploit the correlations. And algorithmically, it's much harder. So I wanted to give you, because it is supposed to be a tutorial, I wanted to give you three or four slides on replicas, which is one of the important tools that we have been using in order to analyze all these systems. Replicas, actually, it has many faces. And I think that most people know only the first one, which is this one, and it's not the most important. But anyhow, I will try to give you at least three different views of what are replicas and why they are useful. So originally, again, I put here the setup of the SK model just to give an example. You want to compute the free energy density for a given sample, a given instance of couplings J. It is self-averaging, that's an hypothesis. And so if it is self-averaging, what you can do is compute the expectation value of F. It means the expectation value of the log Z, of the log of the partition function. And the log of the partition function, you can compute it as a limit when n goes to 0 of z to the n minus 1 over n. Now, z to the n, you can compute it as a sum with n copies of the spins. And so you start with z to the n, you have n uncoupled replicas with the same disorder. You average over disorder, and you find n coupled replicas without disorder. Perfect. You play this game. And also, yes, of course, there is also, as you can see here immediately, there is a SN symmetry, there is symmetry by permutation of all these N replicas. And then the idea is that you have to do the analytic continuation when small n goes to zero, number of replicas goes to zero. This is very bad. The analytic continuation often it's not unique. You are not in, for instance, in SK, you are not within the hypothesis where Karlsson theorem would guarantee you that you have a unit and analytic continuation. You have phase transition in the thermodynamic limit with spontaneous breaking of the SN symmetry, and you have to interchange the number of replicas going to zero and the large size limit. So it's a big mess. I just quote Giorgio in one of his early papers on the thing, which is once you break replica symmetry, the Pandora box is open, which I find a nice...
Now you can call it the Paris box is open.
Something like that. Pandora is nice also. Another interpretation of replicas, which I much prefer, is the following. Again, you start with the free energy density. You assume that there is a large deviation principle. Or you prove it, you ask your friend to prove it for you, that's how I do usually. And so someone proves you that there is a large deviation principle, so you want to identify this large deviation function phi of f, which will give you the number of samples which have a free energy density f. And its maximum will be f star, which will be the free energy of the typical sample. So you reconstruct it by looking at the expectation value of z to the n. Expectation value of z to the n will be an integral over all the free energy density, e to the large n, the number of spins, minus n beta f plus phi of f. So n is, then you can study that with the Laplace method. You take the large n limit, and for any value of small n, you will find a point here, which is a point where this function here is maximum. And in the n going to zero limit, you will identify the true maximum. That's what you really do, actually, when you do a replica analysis. Now, there is a third version, which is even more interesting. It's even more interesting because you can use replicas in systems in which there is no quench disorder. Take a structural glass, you have no disorder, and yet people use replicas. Why? Use replicas because in some systems, even without any quench disorder, you may find this phenomenology of the existence of many clusters, separated clusters. And so if you are there, you will find that for each cluster, there is a partition function with a certain free energy density of the cluster. And so you will approximate the true partition function as the sum of the partition function within each cluster. Now you have a complexity, as we were saying before, which is the number which tells you how many metastable states there are with a certain free energy density, exactly as we were describing before for KSAT. There it was just entropy, it was just the number of solutions that mattered. And you can do that. In order to do that, you can introduce M replicas, or in that setup they are sometimes called cloned, constrained to be in the same state. We have to use some trick in order to be sure that they are aligned. You will put some small attraction, you will, okay, you will have to work a little bit. But you see that if you have M replicas all in the same state, then it means that the full partition function will be the sum of all the clusters of Z in the cluster alpha to the power M. Again, you look at, you group together all the clusters with a given free energy density, you get integral df e to the n, the complexity, minus m beta f. So m will be now a tool, again, to reconstruct the complexity function. A priori, you can do that for a given instance. If you are in a case in which there is disorder, then you will do the disorder average by introducing on top of it n replicas. So you will have the number m will which reconstruct the number of clusters, and n will be a kind of technical trick in order to do the final average. And that's one step RSB. Yes?
In this picture, the size of the circles is now the physical size of the cluster?
Yes. Okay. Except that all this describes unit hypercube in large dimension, it's exponentially large, it's okay. It's only very pictorial, but. So these are three faces of the replicas that I wanted to mention. I think that the general philosophy is the following. You have a system in which you have many pure states or many metastable states. Many clusters. They depend on the sample. And they are extremely difficult to describe. And basically, only the system itself knows this structure. And so basically, the only way you can analyze a system is by comparing a spin configuration with another reference configuration drawn from the system itself. That's the idea of the replicas. I mean, it's behind all these three faces, if you think about it a bit carefully, it's behind there all the time. So the idea of replicas is kind of very basic, very important if you want to analyze quantitatively a problem like that. Okay, let me go to fourth chapter, which is algorithms. And I want to tell you how to analyze one given instance using mean field equations. Just a brief history of mean field equations. In homogeneous ferromagnets, they were studied initially by Weiss, elaborating on the things that were proposed also by Curie. By Beto and Pyles, a few decades later. In glassy systems, by Fowles, Anderson, Palmer. Then we came up with the idea of the cavity method. And in 2001, we found out how to work in system with finite connectivity. All these were done in the physics context without any mentioning of, well, with nearly no mentioning of it as an algorithm. Probably because the physicists were not interested so much in what happens in a given instance. They want to know the self-averaging properties, the phase diagram, what happens to a typical sample. And probably because in any case, if you want to analyze a copper manganese, you have 10 to the 23 spins, and it's not an algorithmic question. It's an analytic question in some sense. Now, if you want to analyze systems in information science or in information theory, computer science, you will deal with systems which have size 1,000, 1 million. And then you can really ask, well, if I give you one sample, what can you do? And it turned out that these mean field equations, they were used as algorithm in different contexts and independently of what had happened in physics, by Gallagher in error-correcting codes, by Pearl for more general constraint satisfaction problem. And then it's gradually there was a connection which was done between the physics approach and these approaches. So let me give you a very brief history of the field. First of all, the mean field of Weiss. It starts from a small computation of Langevin. Langevin studies one spin in a magnetic field and computes the magnetization at finite temperature. So an easy computation. He finds a Langevin function. He finds that the magnetization is a function of a magnetic field divided by temperature. Weiss studies one spin in a ferromagnet and says, okay, let us assume that the local magnetic field is the sum of the external field and the field due to the other spins of the nail. And then he assumes that this field due to the other spins is proportional to their magnetization. And so basically you put it in this formula here, and you can even put the external field going to zero. You find a self-consistent equation that the magnetization is a certain function of the magnetization. You solve this self-consistent equation and you find that there is a ferromagnetic phase transition. And it has actually only two parameters. One is alpha and one is M0. And Weiss goes and does the experiment and finds a beautiful fit to the experiment. Okay, that was a prehistory. Now, how do you do that in modern language? In modern language, you will say you have a spin system. I will compute the magnetization. And basically, I will do some kind of a simple approximation, saying I will assume that the magnetization is the tangent of the local field. And the local field, I can approximate it by the sum of Jij times the magnetization of the other spins. This is in general wrong and in general useless in disordered systems. It totally neglects fluctuation. There is a correct formula, which is that the expectation value of the spin I is equal to the expectation value of the tangent of the local field, but this is not equal to the tangent of the expectation value of the local field. So you neglect correlation. Beto and Piles came up with another idea, and they looked at the exact solution for a central spin I and its neighbors. So this one, and this one, assuming that the neighbors are independent. So you start from this, and then you assume that the neighbors are independent, and you will say, you will look at the local measure of a central spin SI and the neighbors. That's very easy. And with an effective field describing what happens on the neighbors, we find these self-consistent equations. They are an elaboration, the one on Curie and Weiss, and they give you a much better value for the critical temperature, for instance. Now, you can extend that to a disordered case, and when you extend that to the disordered case, you will find a self-consistent equation that relates the local field on I in the absence of J. You can compute it if you know the local field on K in the absence of I, and the local field on L in the absence of I. And this is the result. It's actually the equation that you would find if you work out the local magnetization on a tree, for instance. So these are the equation not written by Beto and Piles, but these are the equation that you obtain if you use the Beto-Piles method in the case in which you have a disordered system and you have J which are not uniform. You can see them as equation that if you have spins interacting on a graph, then for each edge of the graph you will have a field which is the field acting on I in the absence of J, and in the other direction there is a field acting on J in the absence of I. So you have two fields on each edge, and you will have coupled equations for all these fields. Now, the belief propagation algorithm, as it was used in Gallagher and Pearl, etc., it has the same initial Beto-Piles and belief propagation, so I call it BP. So you don't, whatever, everybody in the audience can find his route with BP. The idea of BP algorithm is just to iterate these equations. That is, you will just say, imagine that I know the fields at time t, then I will compute the new field at time t plus 1 using this recursion relation. So these are very easy to iterate. And it's a very general procedure that you can generalize to any constraint satisfaction problem. Not only spins interacting by pairs, but you can use it in KSAT, you can use it in whatever system you are interested in. A small remark on the cavity method. The H with this notation, the spin on I in the absence of J, is a function on the spins of the neighbors in the absence of I. The whole idea behind the Beto and Pyle's hypothesis is to say that these two guys are independent. That is, you forget about the correlation of the neighbors when you compute the effect on a given spin. And that's also the idea of the cavity method, in which basically you do a statistical analysis of the fixed point. If the messages are independent, then you construct the P of H, which is a probability distribution that these messages at time t take a certain value. And the BP equation will lead to a self-consistent equation for P of H. And that's the equation that you solve when you do the cavity method. You will try to find this self-consistent equation. Basically, by looking at a fixed point of this iteration, you have this probability of the messages at time t, and using this recursion, you can deduce from it the probability at time t plus 1, and then you want to implement a fixed point on that. State evolution does not focus only on a fixed point. State evolution is like the cavity, but it will actually follow the evolution, the mapping at each iteration. And it's just the mapping generated by the BP iteration. It's because you have, when you do the state evolution, you have in mind that you are using it as an algorithm. You are not only interested in what is the final structure, in finding a solution of P of H equals F P of H, but you want really to see how the algorithm develops in time. And so you follow that. And that will give you an analytic control of the BP algorithm. That is very close. So when is all that valid? Simple mean field is valid only when you can neglect fluctuations. So this happens only in the case in which you have like the Curie-Weiss model, when you have many neighbors. When is BP exact? BP is exact in one dimension, because BP basically it says that when you look at the influence on this guy, you forget about the correlation between K and J when I is absent. So it's exact in one dimension, it's exact on a tree. It's exact on locally tree-like graphs if the correlations decay fast enough. Locally tree-like graphs like Herde Schreni, they appear when you draw an Herde Schreni graph with finite connectivity, let's say degree 3. And in such a graph, you will have loops, but the loops are long, of size log n. So basically, if I take out I can say that the distance between J and K, it's a long distance. It grows in the thermodynamic limit. So if the correlations decay at large distances, then the BP hypotheses are correct. And so it will mean that it's exact on locally tree-like graph if the correlations decay fast enough. And that will be true if you are in the high temperature phase, or if you are in the low temperature phase and you work within one pure state. And it can be exact in infinite range problems if the correlations again decay fast enough. We mentioned three important developments. There is a special case of infinite range models. I will not elaborate on it, but basically the idea is that the local field, if you have an infinite range model, the local field on a site in the absence of J, it's nearly equal to the local field on the sites with everybody present, because J is only one among the n minus one neighbors. And so you work out the corrections, and you find, you instead of having equations that work on the edges of the graph, you can find equations that work for the local field, the local magnetization, basically, and these are the TAP equations. And the TAP equations, you can iterate them in time, but then you find that there is, in order to find the local field at time t plus 1, you need to know the local field at time t and the local field at time t minus 1. That's the effect of the Onsaga term, in which basically you have one spin I, it polarizes the neighbor and gets a bit of a polarization back, and you have to take that into account. What happens if the elementary variables are real instead of discrete? Well, that works nearly the same, but except that you cannot say that the local measure is characterized by a single number, which is a local magnetic field. You have to characterize a local distribution of the variable, but you will get the same thing. You will get that the probability of the variable xi in the absence of j is a certain functional of the probability of k in the absence of I and the probability of L in the absence of I. In some cases, this can be useful. In particular, if there is large connectivity, large degree, then this function will be approximately Gaussian, and you will be able to use that because they will be characterized by two numbers. And the last point that I want to mention as development, what happens in a glass phase? Well, in a glass phase, you have the what will happen is that you will have the BP equations. They are correct within a given pure state. So if you have many pure states, they will be correct. If you restrict the measure to this state, they will be correct here. But then it means that there are many solutions of the BP equation. And so what you have to do is to do the statistics of these fields over the many states. And so you will look, what is the probability that the field hi to j takes a certain value when you pick up a state at random and you relate to the probability of the neighbors? That's called survey propagation, and that's the one that is the best solver for ksat. So message passing algorithms are extremely good. They solve hard and large constraint satisfaction problem fast. You find the best decoders for a large category of error correction code by iterating the mean field equations. You find the best solver for random satisfiability problem. You find the best algorithm for learning patterns in neural networks like perceptron in the hard case, data clustering, graph coloring, Steiner trees, fully connected networks using tap equations. They are local, simple update equation where each message is updated using information from incoming messages on the same node. And so they, in some sense, they use the same kind of architecture that is used in neural networks. That is, you will have simple units that get the message coming in and with a simple local operation, knowing only the incoming messages, they will produce an output that they will send further away on the along the network. I have two more chapters. Is it how much time? I thought
in principle we should have 20 minutes for discussion.
Okay,
so
that's good.
I could leave you with 10 minutes. Let's
say. Okay, so it will go fast with inference. One of the developments of the last few years, which has been quite substantial in all this field, is Bayesian inference, in which you have some unknown parameters, you have some measurement, and you want to reconstruct the unknowns from the measurement using Bayes' law. The thing which is interesting, well, most challenging, is the case in which you have many unknowns and many measurements. So you will be interested in the large number of unknowns, large number of measurements with a fixed ratio, alpha. And if in the case in which you have independent measurements, for instance, it means that each measurement, mu, is generated from a certain probability distribution of y mu given the unknowns. And then you will have a certain prior on the unknown, and using Bayes' law, you get a posterior, which is what is the probability of the unknown. It is the product of the prior and a factor which tells you what is the probability of the unknown, how is it modified by each of the measurements. This you can call an energy. And so here you realize that you have n unknowns with a certain a priori measure. And then you have an energy function. We take the sum of a lot of terms. Each of them depends on the unknown. So you have a typical case of which looks like a spin glass. And one instance in which this is used quite a lot is machine learning, in which you have an input, You send it through a machine, and you want to get an output. And this, for instance, you have a picture of 100 digits. You want to send it to the machine, and the machine tells you that it was a 5. So in the recent developments based on neural networks, you set up an artificial neural network in which basically each neuron takes the input from a certain number of neurons, does the weighted sum of the signal from the incoming neuron, applies to it a certain function, could be a rectified linear unit, or it could be a sigmoid or whatever, and outputs the result. So in this game, there is a simple perceptron, which has one input, one output, or one input layer, one output layer. Then the outputs decouple, and the architecture boils up to this. And you can have a two-layer network. And so, for instance, you could look at the handwritten digit recognition, saying you have the initial image, it has 784 pixels. You take an intermediate layer with 15 neurons, and the output layer is 10 neurons because it has to give you what is the number, what is the digit between 0 and 10. This neural network is very simple. It depends on 11,925 parameters. These are all the synaptic weights. And basically, you can ask yourself, what is the best choice of these synaptic weights so that when I will present a digit, it will be able to read it. Nobody knows how to do that a priori, but you can teach the machine how to do it by taking a database of many digits. And so you will have M examples of input-output. But you know the output. For each example, you know the output. For each example, you know someone has been asked to draw a 0, and that's what he did, or to draw, what is that, a 4, and that's what he did, etc. And so you use this database, and you want just to find these 11,000 parameters such that for each input in the database, the output is as close as possible to the one you want. Is it output the 4 or the second image that you had before? And so this is typically a learning problem, and you can ask what is the probability of the weights given the database. It has its prior, and it has this fitting or training function, which tells you you want to find the weights such that you perform well on the database. And of course, once you have that, you have you will want to know if the machine works well by looking at the generalization error. So this is the setup, and you will tell me, well, there is a lot of hypothesis here. There is this prior, which is notoriously complicated, but that's intrinsic to Bayesian learning. Actually, there are many more priors. The whole architecture of the machine that you are using is a prior in some sense. And so you can actually, the machine that I was showing with only 15 neurons in the intermediate layer, you can train it to work quite well. So there are two issues in this training. One is algorithmic and the other one is theoretical. Algorithmically, you are asking about the optimization in large dimensional space with a disordered energy function, which looks very much like highly probable that it will be a glassy one, so there are landscape issues. And in the theory, you will apply these ideas to large size systems, so that's fine. But if you want to do any kind of theory on that and to understand something, you need a model of the data. You need a model of the disorder. You need an ensemble. And ideally, what you would like to have is a generative model that will generate for you, will give you a probability distribution that generates for you the set of input-output pairs, the database. But for that, you have a smart description. You need a smart description of the database, not only a list of images of handwritten digits. And so this need for an algorithm, for an ensemble, is crucial if you want to analyze correctly what happens in the learning. For instance, in the 80s, many of the works that were done by physicists in order to analyze the phase diagram, you know, you look at the perceptron, you see the threshold, when it is able to learn, not able to learn, and so on. You do it with IID patterns. And I think that it's something that we really missed, that we really did in an incorrect way for many years or decades. That is, we didn't have a rich enough model of the world, model of the data. So the challenge is to find a good generative models of the world. My claim is that in the present situation, the new deep learning systems, they work pretty well because the model of the world that they are well adapted to the kind of problems that are being asked, which is, for instance, vision or language. Let me, because I see that Giulio was looking at his watch, so let me just go one last chapter very rapidly. I want. I can leave you with the landscape and just talk. That's it's Tuscany. You guess it. Let me tell you a little bit about correlations. I think that in statistical physics, a lot of work that has been done has been relying on disorder which was IID. Take SK model, it's IID disorder. But then it turns out that everything that we are constructing relies on the type of ensemble, or what is the system, how it is generated. And so imagine that you look at the TAP equations, for instance, that they are correct equations if the JIJ are independent random variable. Otherwise, they are not correct. And so there are several examples, but let me mention one example which has been studied a lot, which is easy. Imagine that you want to look at Hopfield model. In Hopfield model, you have binary spins, and you want to memorize special configurations, which are called patterns. And so you construct the JIJ not as random Gaussian variables, but as a superposition of patterns, Xi I mu, Xi j nu. For each pattern, you take the product, Xi I mu, Xi j nu. You superimpose all of them, you construct the JIJ this way. It looks like a spin glass, it looks like a SK model, except that the ensemble is different, because you have generated the J from a new ensemble, which is this guy. And you could ask, well, in this case, can I just draw the phase diagram? Well, you can do it, this had been done long ago, but what are the mean field equations? Well, initially, the first thing that you could say is, well, in the end, I have written my mean field equation for an arbitrary set of J's, so I could use the TAP equations. These are wrong. These do not apply to the SK model. TAP is valid only if you have, in TAP, there is this Onsager term, which tells you that I polarizes J, which repolarizes I, and you have to take that into account. In the Hopfield model, because you have this superposition principle which gives you the J's, the product of three J's is no longer zero, the expectation value of this product. It means that you have to take into account indirect polarization, in which I polarizes J, polarizes K, polarizes I. And you have to do that, and that modifies the TAP equation. One easy way to do it, and I will be very fast, but that's just technical, using Hubbard-Stratanovich transformation, you can write the Hopfield model as a model in which you have Ising variables and Gaussian variables, which correspond physically to the projection on the patterns. And then you couple the Gaussian variable with the Ising variable, and the coupling is just the pattern. And so in terms of graphical models, you have the spins, which are the neurons. You have these new variables which have the projection of the activity of the network on the pattern. So this lambda mu will be high when the network is close to the pattern number mu. And you couple them with this coupling, which are Xi I mu over n. Now in these graphs, the couplings are IID. And so you can, with this IID coupling, you can work out all your technique of using BP and mean field equation, and they are correct. So you write the messages and you turn the crank, and after turning the crank for long enough, you find that you have new tap equations, and they boil up to, you do it carefully, and you find these new tap equations in which there is a new reaction term which was not present before. So it means that changing the ensemble of J, it changes your mean field equations. And if you didn't know that the J's had these kind of correlations, then you use you can use the usual tap equation, they are wrong. Now, one small exercise that I did, and I will just finish with that, is in order to have something which tells you how important is the model of the world. Imagine that instead of memorizing random patterns, IID with IID components, you generate your patterns from a superposition of elementary features. It means that a pattern, you will generate it as a superposition with features UR, and you sum them, you sum a certain number of them. So you generate a pattern by saying, I have some features, and I will take this and that feature, and that will be a pattern. So it's this kind of compositional world, and I claim that this is really the world that, in which actually deep networks, for instance, they are very good at doing that, and we will see why later. That is, if you take an image, then you will have there is a compositional structure in this image. I mean, a chair, it has 4 feet, and then it has et cetera. I mean, and this is room, there are 50 persons, and each of them is built of a face, and it's all compositional. Now, this is the simplest example that I, as a mathematician, I can build of a compositional disorder. And I think that we need to study compositional disorder. Now I do a little bit of computation. I will skip that very rapidly. You disentangle it through another Hrabat-Stratonovich. You find that you have to represent the system in terms of the neuron, the patterns, and the features. And the couplings go this way. You have the neuron, which are coupled to the features, which are coupled to the patterns. On that, you have IID variables on each of them. You can do the mean field equations. And you have new tap equations. And basically, you find that spontaneously, if you want to write the correct tap equations for this model, which has a compositional structure in the disorder, you have the three-layer structures. And so this is certainly a correct computation of tap equations. It's a very small step in order to put forward the hypothesis about the success of deep network. But basically, in deep network, what you have is the original world, for instance, an image. Then you will start to look at small-scale features, and then a bit larger-scale features, which are made of groups. So, for instance, in the first layer, you will find some edges, then you will find some lines, and then you will find some tetra, and then later on, you will find some the eye or the mouth or something which is more and more combined of elementary patterns. And so, My impression is that the very architecture of layered and deep networks is adapted to the to analyzing a task in which the world itself, the model of the world, has this combinatorial structure made of a pattern is composed of features, which is composed of sub-features, which is composed of sub-sub-features. So, two take-home messages. One is the spin-glass cornucopia, which just a kind of a intellectual message saying that these are totally useless, boring materials. There are a few grams that exist, and nobody cares, but many people have written many papers on that, and they have found in some sense a kind of broad scope of applications in many other fields. And among the take-home messages, I want to insist on the fact that basically there was this trend. At some point there was the idea of the cavity method, for instance, which is to be able to do an analytic computation to give you a phase diagram. And for a long time, there was a gap between that and an algorithm, just because there was a gap of interest of what is it that you want to do. And now in the last decade, there is this big development of mean-field approaches, more and more sophisticated, in which solve very non-trivial problems in computer science and information theory. And last, I want to insist on this idea of an ensemble, because I think that this idea that what we apply machine learning to and the new developments of deep learning, it's not a random world with plus or minus one IID inputs. It is a very structured world, and I insist that its compositeness, its combinatorial structure, is absolutely crucial. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there is now time for questions, comments.
No, that's true. That's true. Here, in my case, I was still looking at a mean-field model of the Hopfield type, in some sense, in which there is no spatial structure. That is, the neurons are not related to a position in space. They are not living in a finite dimensional space. So this is far away. I mean, there is a big thing to do. But of course, what I think is that if you apply a deep network for vision, for seeing if there is a cat on an image, then you will have to use this idea of the compositeness together with the fact that it is a two-dimensional pattern, that it lives in a two-dimensional space. And then, naturally, you start by having convolutional network in the sense that you have kernels that analyze locally and that apply to every piece of the image. That is, you will have to add the two-dimensional structure to the image that I was using.
It sort of gets less and less two-dimensional.
Yes.
And more and more.
Yes.
Global.
But that is how it goes, actually, because it goes this way. The first layers are purely kernel convolution, actually sometimes hardwired, dictated to the system, and the part that you learn, the new W that you learn, is really towards the end of the network.
Other questions?
Almost finished slide. So when you mentioned this model of the world, just before that you had this item saying there's the landscape questions.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if your model of the world is not IID, the complexity, the geometric complexity of the landscape changes.
Yes.
Completely too.
Definitely.
Possibly, maybe not, but possibly.
Yes, yes. Then there is, you can even have a more daring conjecture in some sense, saying that these networks, these deep networks, they are kind of mimicking, at least in their philosophy of how they work, mimicking the architecture of neurons. They take inputs, process it, do a small computation, put it to another one, and so on. And in some sense, they are, for instance, for vision, they are in some sense also related to the various what the neurons do in the various visual areas, V1, V2, etc. And that maybe it explains why these systems, they are more successful in doing tasks which are very difficult, but tasks like vision or like language understanding, which can also be mapped, because you basically, for language, you go to time frequency analysis, so it's also a kind of two-dimensional patterns, and so it's maybe not by case.
Yeah, if you take a simplified subset of the MNIST data and just try to identify the number two or not two, and throw a simple, single, hidden layer network at that, the landscape turns out to be quite nicely funneled. So you get an ensemble of local minima that perform almost equally well, but misclassify different things, separated by quite low barriers. But there was one interesting thing about that. you showed some numbers where I think there was the number 4, which many humans here probably wouldn't have identified as a number 4. It really was pretty horrible. And I wonder how much those outliers throw out the fitting process. There's an analog in healthcare where you get outliers for a certain subset of patients who are always more likely to die. And they're the alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And they never tell you that they're alcoholics. If you could deduce they were alcoholics and remove them, like some of the malformed letters, all of these things would do a lot better because we're forcing the system to learn some things that are really bad data. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, the only thing I know is that the simple example they was showing, this case of a two-layer networks with 15 neurons in the hidden layer. Why 15? I mean there is a lot of art in all of that. I mean, that's what I should have said that before. I consider that the whole development of deep network is beautiful, it's challenging and so on, but it's an art. Mm-hmm. Because you say you start with 700 in the first layer, that's the image. You finish with 10, but in between what you do, you try. Basically, it's trial and error. What I remember is that in this case, with 15 neurons in the hidden layer, there were outliers. There were digits that were not recognized correctly. And when you look at them, you don't know what they are, these digits. So, I mean, that was kind of good in some sense that you have the same kind of... the outlier, you can also see that they are outliers for us. But it doesn't mean that all these neural networks are behaving the way that our brain behaves. I mean, as we know, there are many, many examples of the contrary. For instance, you can have a very good neural network that identifies an ape, but then you change a few pixels and it's no longer able to identify it at all. Well, for us, it's the same picture. So it means that the mechanism is still... So I think there is a lot of work to be done.
Other questions? Okay, so if not, think again. And so, and it's now time for the coffee break. And we come here again at 11.